Church. Austin told me there'll only be about 20 people here today. I think he's off by a little bit, but it's okay. I forgive him. So today we're here. My name is Andrew Peterson. This is my wife, Caitlin Peterson. And we are invited just to share our story on our passion for missions, for service. And for both of us, it kind of began. The seeds were planted by our grandparents. We both actually have grandparents who were in the mission fields. Myself, my grandparents were in Africa for 17 years in both Kenya and Uganda, and they served in various other roles for the General Conference. And for Caitlin's grandparents?
My grandparents, they started off in the Philippines, and then they moved to Thailand and Laos, where they served in the mission field for 22 years. My grandfather was a pastor, and my grandmother was an English teacher. And like Andrew said, whether they knew it or not, just from their stories alone, they were planting seeds for the both of us. For me, it was more of an overnight realization of what I wanted my life to look like. There, I spent a few months as a nursing volunteer, and I really developed a passion for service and other people. Africa, for me, was my Rubicon. I knew that I couldn't go home living the life that I had lived. Like, it had to be about service, but for Andrew, it was a little different.
For me, it wasn't as much as an overnight thing. It was sort of gradual. My grandfather paid for my first mission trip when I was in the seventh grade back in 2003. And after that, through high school, I went on various trips. And about the end of high school is when I really felt it within my heart that service, being in the mission field, was something that I wanted to do. And yet, when people would ask me, you know, that typical question for a senior, hey, what are you going to study when you go to college? I would kind of find myself not really wanting to say, I wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do, and I didn't want to tell them I was going into the mission field yet, so I would tell them, oh, I'm going to, you know, be just something else, just to appease them, I guess. And it was really when I came to La Sierra that I wasn't afraid anymore to say a life of service is something I want to do.
I had gone to Africa when I was 18. After my time there, I transferred here to La Sierra University, and it's actually in the missions office department where Andrew and I first met. At first, we were just, you know, talking, getting to know each other, but obviously, you know, they're dating, and we were very intentional about dating. We would have these late night conversations about what we wanted out of life, about what kind of spouse we wanted, and whatever endeavor that we would embark on, service had to be at the core of our life. And so I just want to note that La Sierra for us is a special place. Because even though the seeds blossomed before we came to La Sierra, it is here where it really flourished. La Sierra did such a beautiful job in nurturing our passion for missions. And so during our senior year, Andrew, he was the student director of the missions department, and I was the religious vice president of the student association. And I wanted to do a project, but I wasn't sure exactly like what to do. I wanted something for the student body to engage in. And during that time, that's when the Syrian crisis was surfacing on the news. And I would read like story after story. And after that summer, like I just knew like this is the thing that this is the project that I want to do. And so I started Project Syria, where it was just raising awareness for the Syrian refugees. And I actually had the opportunity to go to Jordan to visit some of the refugees out there, interview them. And Andrew and I had only been dating for a little over a year. And so I wanted him to come, but this is a really big trip going across the world with someone. And so I didn't know how to ask him. But it ended up like my dad told me like I couldn't even go unless Andrew went, because for safety reasons. So it worked out really well. And before we left, we actually had this jacket drive that this church participated in. And we brought a bunch of jackets that you guys donated and gave them, because we went in December and there was a lot of snow, it was very cold, and we gave a lot of the jackets to the refugees.
So the end of that year, we graduated in 2014, and the following summer, 2015, is when we got engaged. And for as much as neither of us like surprises, we both like surprising the other person. And so we were actually secretly planning the honeymoon, and little did we know, we actually had the same idea in mind, because it was last summer when it seemed like every day on the news we would hear stories about families coming across the Mediterranean, children dying, making that journey, and we were both planning to surprise the other one with a trip to an island in Greece. Luckily, we caught on before we bought four tickets, and Sid just had two. And so we knew that we couldn't go anywhere else on our honeymoon besides to that location where we knew of all the things going on there.
And so when we got to Greece, we didn't know a single person. We didn't know exactly what we were doing. We kind of just went on faith. And when we got there, we were talking to each other and told ourselves that worst comes to worst, we will just buy sandwich supplies, make sandwiches, and just stand on the beach waiting for refugees to come in from Turkey and just give them sandwiches, because we didn't really have a game plan. But we did some research while we were there. And Andrew had found this NGO at a hotel, and they were lending out their whole building for refugees that were coming in from Turkey to spend the night to recoup, so that when they went to Europe, they'd be a little more refreshed, had a good night's sleep type of thing. And we weren't there very long, so we wanted to maximize our time. So we were basically working like 20-hour days. First in the morning, we would start off with sorting out clothes. There was a warehouse with boxes coming in from all over the world. And we had two piles, one pile for refugees that were coming in from Turkey. They would always be sopping wet, so we always had dry clothes for them. And then the second pile was for refugees that were going into Europe. We had like wool coats, gloves, scarves, because this was in December, right after we got married. And you know, it's snowing in Germany, France, it's freezing, and that's many of their destinations. So we did that, and then after our time in the warehouse, we would go to a restaurant where they would close down for a few hours to feed the refugees one last meal before going out to Europe. And there I worked in the back preparing the food, and Andrew was serving the food. And also while we were there, the island of Kos isn't very big, so just walking around from like one side to the other, there's just life jackets everywhere. Like after the refugees come in from Turkey, they just have like one thing in mind just to continue their journey, so they just drop off their life jackets everywhere you walk, on the beach, on like the sides of the restaurants, the alleyways, everywhere. It's just life jackets everywhere. But we would end our nights at the harbor.
And at the harbor, the NGO that we were working with, they had set it up where it was called Boat Departure. The refugees that had been there and gone through the beginning of the registration process, they would then get on a ferry to Athens, and then from there they would continue traveling on. And so we would start out the night with preparing them for their journey. And after the ferry left, we would then set up for the shift that was all through the night that would be ready for when families would come across on the boats. And so what we would do is, as the families would come in, it was an awesome experience, because it wasn't just our NGO that was there. There's Doctors Without Borders, there was the UNHCR, all working together The UNHCR would bring them on a bus and bring them to the harbor. We would then help get them, give them dry clothes that they can get out of their wet clothes, because it was already cold, and then being wet on top of that, hypothermia was not far behind. And there was, like I said, Doctors Without Borders ready to provide medical attention. There was a group there just giving food and something warm to drink. And so they're all working together, and throughout the night we encountered many families, many individuals who were, and listened to their stories, telling us of the journey and where they had come from, why they decided to leave, and things like that.
And so when we left Greece, or even in Greece, like, we would talk about our day, like what we just experienced. And we both knew that it was a life-changing experience. It was a pivotal point in our lives. And together with our experience in Jordan, it was, our desire for refugees was pretty much set in stone. Like, we knew that refugees were important to us, they were special to us, that we couldn't just ignore the stories in the news. We couldn't just pretend that, like, it wasn't happening. And we hope to go back in December for our one-year anniversary, but we'll see.
So we've kind of shared with how the seeds were planted in us, where it has taken us. And now as we look to the future, we just constantly hope that this service and desire to help others is at the center, and that we don't grow weary of reaching our dreams of service, and that instead this desire burns stronger, that our hearts don't go numb to all the tragedies that we seem to almost be hearing on a daily basis, and instead that they continue to break for those who have broken hearts and that need our help. We thank this community for letting us share our story, and we thank you for being a part of it.
You saw a picture of Caitlin holding a little kid, and next to her was a man in a black trench coat. Can we put that picture back up? So the funny story about this picture is that that coat actually belonged to Pastor Chris, and she swears it used to be cool in the 90s. But there came a time when Caitlin and Andrew were announcing that they were having this coat drive, and Amanda and Elisa insisted that Chris needed to be free of this jacket. No, but it used to be cool. Yeah, but it's not the 90s. It's now the 2000s. So she sent it off, and then she gets this picture of who is wearing it, but a full-grown man. So that was an I told you so moment in the Oberg household, from what I hear. I think it's not a coincidence. I think it is providence that these two were speaking today. I look to them and I see hope. If we're going to be honest, it could be hard to be hopeful. It could be hard to be hopeful when you hear about, in our own Adventist community, losses. When you remember that a year ago Wednesday, we had a session, a GC session, that had regretful outcomes. It can be hard to be hopeful when you see evidence of all people groups, including our people group, becoming more suspicious, more fearful of each other, tensions growing day by day. It can be hard to be hopeful when it seems like we're missing the point sometimes. It can be hard to be hopeful when you turn on the news and you scroll through social media and you're confronted with videos of Alton Sterling's murder on Tuesday, Philando Castile's on Wednesday. It's hard to be hopeful when I really take a look at myself and I recognize that I often squander the unique opportunities that my privilege offers, the voice that it gives me to fight vehemently against inequality and oppression and racism in our society, and I'm too often inactive and therefore enabling to the problem. And for this, I repent. It's hard to be hopeful when you see trouble in Istanbul, in Afghanistan, in Bangladesh, in Iraq. When you see people gathering in worship spaces not terribly different from this one, attacked during their most sacred time for the Muslim religion. And then come the atrocities of Thursday night in Texas. It can be hard to be hopeful when you look around and see growing fear, mistrust, anger. It can be hard to be hopeful in a world that seems to be self-destructing around us. Earlier this week, the pastors, we were in conversation with Dr. Kendra Holowiak-Valentine, and she said something that she might not have thought was all that quotable, but I took note. She said, the opposite of faith isn't necessarily doubt. The opposite of faith is actually fear. But it's hard not to be fearful. It can be hard to be hopeful for a young millennial pastor when I see so many of my friends losing hope that there really is meaning in being part of the church, that there's really much meaning in engaging in the political process and humanitarian efforts, because what change can we really affect anyway? Can the self-destructive machine of society really change course for the better? Can the seemingly irreparable damage being done in social spheres, the damage being done to the environment, the insanity of gun violence and brutality, the poisoning of religion to turn the faithful into assassins rather than lovers, the damage being done seemingly to creation as a whole, can any of it really be reversed and changed? But then I look to friends like Andrew and Caitlin. And if these two don't make you feel hopeful, I don't know what will. I mean, look at them. They're beautiful. This is them with their kids, by the way. When I hear their story, I hear the same sentiment of the prophet Jeremiah. In chapter 19 of the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah hears a word from God. Israel, you're hopeless. Israel, you're wayward. Israel, you are mistreating the poor amongst you. You are filling the temple with the blood of the innocent. Israel is offering their children as sacrifices to other gods, gods of greed and of violence and of hatred. God is angry with the way your leaders are taking you, Israel, says Jeremiah. So you can imagine that Israel's leaders didn't take kindly to hearing this, and Jeremiah was beaten, he was put into stocks, and then he starts this monologue. He says, you deceived me, Lord. You have deceived me, and I was deceived. You overpowered me and prevailed. I am ridiculed all day long. Everyone mocks me. Whenever I speak, I cry out, proclaiming violence and destruction. So the word of the Lord has brought me insult and reproach all day long. Jeremiah is wondering how it has come to this when he was just being the mouthpiece for the message he was receiving. He saw a different reality, the divine reality where God is calling us to take care of each other and not abuse each other. It's not enough to just turn a blind eye to the abuse. Neutrality is a lie for Jeremiah. It does not exist when it comes to abuse. There is no middle way. To try and take a middle way is to err on the side of oppression. Jeremiah is calling Israel towards God's reality because he has seen something different. And once you see, you can't unsee. It changes you. He's seen the oppression, and he can't unsee it. But he's also seen God's ideal, and he can't unsee it. Once you've seen, you can't unsee. So there Jeremiah is in the stocks. There he is, beaten, feeling abandoned by God, questioning whether there is any hope for a stop to the madness he sees growing like a disease around him. questioning whether the God who he believed he was serving is seeing the injustice happening to him and around him. And if God does see it, does God even care? But then Jeremiah says this, "But if I say, I will not mention God's word or speak anymore in God's name, God's word is in my heart like a fire shut up in my bones, and I am weary of holding it in. Indeed, I cannot." When I hear Caitlin and Andrew tell their story, I hear them saying, we've seen and we can't unsee. We've seen injustice and we can't unsee. We've had our hearts broken. We've seen things that leave us feeling hopeless, and it's changed our reality, and it's given us a fire in our bones. It's given us an itch, and we choose hope. Hope that we can do something about it. And there is hope. There is hope that two 20-something lovers can change things around them. I know this because I know that there is hope for all of us that we can bring change around us. There is hope that they can resist apathy because there is hope for all of us to stay engaged and resist a neutral and therefore enabling position. There is hope that they can stave off the nihilism that creeps in cold and dark because there is hope for all of us to hang on to awe and wonder and fight for beauty and rage against the dying of the light. There is hope for Caitlin and Andrew to do incredible, inspirational work with refugees because there is hope for all of us in each moment to say yes to the urgent invitation to join God, to help stop the bleeding, to be God's hand putting pressure on the wound, to be God's words whispering, or rather shouting. The time has come to be loud for justice, for hope, for love. The speaker and author Glennon Melton Doyle tweeted this not too long ago. Someone was questioning why she cried so much. She's known for being an emotional person. She says this. Somebody asked me, "Why do you cry so often, Glennon?" Her response, "For the same reason I laugh so often, because I'm paying attention." Paying attention can be a painful thing. Empathy hurts. But paying attention is also where joy comes from, and it's where hope comes from. And I'm not saying if you don't get overly emotional every time you turn on the news that you're calloused, but I am saying that if we choose to open our hearts to the world, it's going to hurt sometimes, but it also opens the door for joy, for hope, for love. If we open our hearts and we open our eyes, it'll hurt, but it's also how we see God moving, sometimes just in the peripheral. I see God moving in Caitlin and Andrew. I see God moving in the handful of kids that show up on Wednesday mornings at 8 a.m., which is pretty early during the summertime, to help at community services along with the elders, much older and wiser. Those older and wiser often donating their time during their hard-earned retirement time. I see God moving all over these pews. I see God moving in the squirmy, wormy kids that are sitting here and the hardworking parents beside them. I see God moving in those of you that chose this gathering on a Saturday. It seems fitting that we're in a series called If These Pews Could Talk. I see God moving here in these pews. When you're paying attention is when you're liable to have your heart broken by the world, but it's also when hope takes hold. The late and great Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel said the following in an interview on NBC in 1972. He said this, "If I had just one moment, I would say to young people a number of things. I would say, let them remember that there is meaning beyond absurdity. Let them be sure that every little deed counts, that every word has power, and we do, everyone, we do our share to redeem the world in spite of all absurdities and all frustration and all the disappointment. And above all, remember that the meaning of life is to live life as if it were a work of art. One author explains that the tradition of benediction comes from the idea that bene, good, dictio, saying or word, a benediction, a good word, a good saying would be pronounced on the gathering at the end of a gathering to seal their time together, and this word would in some way travel with the group as they left the doors and went to their own homes, that this good word would follow you around in some unique way, and this word would start to become part of your life, part of your heart. So friends, a good word, a benediction. May hope follow you. May it travel with you. May it work its way into your heart. May you find yourself embracing the honesty of being caught between hope and hopelessness, with heart open to the pain all around us, and with a fire in our bones to fight the good fight alongside the prophet Jeremiah, alongside Caitlin and Andrew, alongside the people in the pews next to you, alongside the God that calls us to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our hand clutching onto the hope that God can do and is doing something new. Go forth, fellow warriors of the light. Go and do, bring dignity and respect, fierce joy and ferocious love to confront all fear and anger and division that you find. Go forth, warriors of hope, and be good words in a world that needs to hear a delicate and yet robust, fierce, transformative word of hope. May you go in hope, friends and family. Happy Sabbath.